Before World War II, cattle were fed out on various grasses called hay. Today, cattle are fed out on grains like corn and soy, antibiotics, and other medicinal and nutritional supplements. Some are now turning back to grass-fed, which leads us to ask, is grass-fed meat for the elite?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 736th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Port Stanley who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards back at the studios. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Folks, for today we're broadcasting live from the Certified Farmers Markets of the Monterey Bay Area, one of the 10 best farmers markets in the United States. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and we're especially proud to be helping them celebrate their 35th anniversary here in the Central Coast of California. Today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the foods that you can find here at the market and other certified farmers markets around the Central Coast and elsewhere, especially grass-fed beef. You know, before World War II, all beef cattle were raised on a diet of grasses. Today, cattle are started out on a diet of grass, then finished off on a diet of grains like corn and soy, supplemented with antibiotics and other medicinal and nutritional materials. You know, there are advantages to the modern way of feeding out cattle. Animals gain weight faster, they can produce year-round, are easier and more cost-effective to raise, and thus less expensive. And they also produce what some say is a richer, more rewarding taste. Nevertheless, some say the old ways of grass-fed are best. A study commissioned by the Kellogg Foundation offers the following nutritional comparison of grass and grain-fed. Grass-fed beef has almost double the beta-carotene, which is converted by the human body into vitamin A, which is essential for vision, bone growth, reproduction, cell division, and differentiation. Grass-fed has almost three times the natural vitamin E, which is a powerful antioxidant that protects cells against the free radicals that may lead to chronic health problems like cancer and cardiovascular diseases. And grass-fed has approximately 60% more omega-3 fatty acids and a more favorable ratio of omega-3s to omega-6s, thus protecting against inflammation, blood clotting, and tumor growth. Grass-fed has approximately 2.5 times more conjugated linoleic acid, thus protecting against cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and obesity. And this is CLA is so important that even grain-fed raisers are now supplementing with it in their grain mixtures. The benefits of grass feeding, however, come at a cost. Grass-fed is more expensive to produce and hence more expensive to consume. This leads us to ask, is grass-fed meat for the elite? Here to help us wrangle up an answer, we have Elizabeth Shelley from Tassajara Natural Meats in Carmel Valley, California. Elizabeth, welcome. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good. So you've done this a lot, right, I hear?
We started about a year and a half ago.
Really?
As a business.
Mm-hmm.
But we started eating grass-fed beef ourselves as a family about 15 years ago.
So you're very new in the business then.
Fairly new, yes.
Good, good. What is natural meats?
Natural...
That's what it says on your title, yeah. Right here, natural meats.
Well, we can't claim to be organic. Grass, cows are grass-fed.
And ruminants,
They're grown on grass that hasn't been touched probably for 100 years. So they're organic, but we cannot claim to
So you're not certified organic.
We're not certified.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Fair enough. Also with us today, we have Debbie Dolworth from Dogwood Farm in La Center, Kentucky. Debbie, are you there? Maybe.
Hello?
Are you there? Can we hear you? Nikki, are you there?
Hello.
Oh, I can hear you now. Welcome aboard, Debbie. Good to have you here. Can you hear me? Hello?
Okay, maybe she can't hear you.
I can't hear.
You can't hear him?
Oh.
Oh.
So that's an interesting problem. Well, why do we have that problem?
I'm not sure.
I could hear him until I spoke.
Can you hear him now?
Hello.
Okay. All right, Debbie, I'm going to put you back on hold, and when he's just going to introduce you.
Okay, I'm going to introduce you and then pick her up right away. Debbie is from Dogwood Farm. Now, I have Debbie aboard today because when I sent out a press release challenging the community about the whole notion of grass-fed beef, I just said, you know, is this meat for the elite and really something that doesn't really make sense for the broad population at large? And Debbie said, well, wait a minute. The people who buy our food are not the elite. They're people from Kentucky, and maybe we have a doctor and maybe we have a lawyer, but by and large, these are regular people who have a different reason for going after our meat. So, Debbie, why do people shop for your meat? Can you pick her up? Hello? Guess not. Well, okay, I guess that is not going to work. So we do have Elizabeth Shelley here.
Would you like me to answer that?
Yes, your turn to answer.
Okay. I think that people who buy our meat are people who are concerned about their health and the health benefits of grass-fed beef. And the comments that I get from people a lot are that they are cutting back on the amount of meat that they're eating, but the meat that they want to eat, they want it to be healthy and they want it to be flavorful. And so they look for healthy meats, and, you know, this is beginning to be in the press more, the whole idea of grass-fed beef being better, more healthy for you, for all those reasons that you read.
Yeah, the Kellogg Foundation, what they did is they asked, well, is grass-fed really better? And so what they did is they hired some graduate students to look through the scientific literature. And that's what the students came up with, was all of these reasons. One of the things that really struck me, of course, is the whole notion of the relationship between omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. That this is a very significant nutritional benefit, that you actually get what you really need in a balanced way.
Yes, and more importantly is the ratio that you mentioned. More omega-3s to omega-6s.
Omega-6s,
yes.
Right.
And another aspect that people come to my table and talk to me about is that they're becoming more aware of the environmental aspects of grass-fed beef as opposed to a feedlot.
So there's environmental reasons as well as nutritional reasons.
Yes.
Okay, let's before we do that, I'd like to know how it is you got involved in raising grass-fed beef. I mean, how did your family start Tassajara Natural Meats?
Well, we, like
I said,
because
you just started.
Yeah,
you're a year old.
Well, about 15 years ago, my husband has a really good friend whose family owns a couple of cow-calf operation ranches, and they're not, they don't run the cattle because they want to sell them. They just raise them. They're properties under the Williamson Act.
Right.
And, you know, so they have to have cattle on their properties. And as part of they also have cattle because they need to keep the grasses down.
Right.
As part of, you know, the environmental.
So you have cows and you don't know what to do with them, right?
Yeah.
They're
so,
lawnmowers, expensive lawnmowers.
Exactly. So one year we asked them, I said, well, what, because they have the mother cows and then each year they have babies and the babies go away every year. And so we're like, well, what do you do with these
Where
cows?
Do they go?
Where do they go? And they said, well, they go to auction. And we said, well, can we buy one before it goes to auction and just see what it's like?
Uh-huh.
So we did, and we purchased one cow, and we thought, well, we would share it with friends, but it was so good that we kept the whole thing, and it took us about 3 years to get through it. It was frozen, of course. And we just never looked back from there. The meat was so good, and we every year, we, you know, after those first 3 years, we'd get some from them. And then about 5 years ago, we moved from the coast inland. And when we would drive and commute back to the coast, we would go by all these ranches where we'd see all these cows. And the same thought was, well, where all these cows go? And we just thought it was a shame that they were all going to auction and going to feedlots. And then who knows where they would go after that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the typical way of that cattle are raised. They're started out on grass.
Yeah,
just like your calves are,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think probably close to 100% of cows in this country are started on grass.
Mm-hmm.
So the first
six to nine months or so.
Until they're weaned, basically.
Right. So when people see all those cattle out there and all the calves playing around, and that's how they're started.
Yes.
They just started out on grass. And,
yes.
And then we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about where those calves go, so we can really see the other side to this equation, which, of course, is the grain-fed cattle. Two ways of doing things, folks. Raise them on grain, raise them on grass. Some say this grass-fed business is just meat for the elite. Well, that's what we're talking about today. Is it meat for the elite, or is it meat for you and I? What do you think? Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We're broadcasting live today from the Certified Farmers Markets of the Monterey Bay Area, celebrating the 35th anniversary. And what fun, what a lot of people carry around, beautiful flowers, families, kids. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, broadcasting live from the Certified Farmers Markets of the Monterey Bay Area today. Mike Lolson here, your host, with Elizabeth Shelley. Tassajara Natural Meats. Gosh, just a year and a half in business. Yes. Are you having fun?
Yes, I'm enjoying it immensely.
Uh-huh. So we were talking about the two ways in which cattle are raised, beef, and you know, beef are kind of like not the only ones that are going through this industrialization process, and that's what we're talking about right now. How you know, when calves are raised, they spend 6 months or 9 months on grass in pastures, and then they're put in trucks. What happens to them then, Elizabeth?
Well, some of the animals will be, they'll be taken to auction, mm-hmm. the majority. And then some of them will be purchased at auction and taken to other pastures to be grass-fed for a little while longer. But eventually, most of them will end up in a feedlot.
In a feedlot.
Yeah, for about 6 months before they are harvested.
Okay. So in a feedlot, that's kind of the new way of doing things. After World War II, we started feeding ruminants grain.
Yes, it became cheap. Uh-huh. Corn started to be subsidized, and also because of the breeding of corn and how they were able to increase the yield in a field, then it became very cheap to process corn and feed it to animals as a cheap feed.
And now we're feeding them soybeans?
Soy as well.
Soy?
It's also it's become very cheap to grow soy and feed mm-hmm. them. And when you can pack many cows into a small area and feed them cheaply, then it becomes more
economic,
efficient.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's the whole notion behind this cheap beef that we have. Now, how is it that we get ruminants to eat grain? I mean, is there some kind of special mechanism here?
Well, they don't coat the corn with something that's appetizing for ruminant. They just eat it. Mm-hmm. They'll eat, you know, horses will eat corn and grain too. They like it.
Sure.
But it's not very good for their system.
So I hear that creates a different kind of environment in the ruminant's stomach.
Yes, it's hot for them, and it creates, it actually increases the amount of E. coli that lives in their gut. And so whereas there's always E. coli, we have E. coli, but because of this environment that's created, the amount of E. coli is actually, I don't know how many times more,
sure.
it increases dramatically. and causes them to be sick.
And then some people say that the E. coli 0157H7, which is now wreaking havoc on the food chain, is likely caused by feeding cattle.
Well, because of the antibiotics that they have to feed them because they're sick, the E. coli become immune, basically, to the antibiotic. And so they become stronger.
So not only do they feed them grain, but they have to feed them antibiotics.
Yes.
And other
things. I think in general they just add antibiotic to the feed without the cow actually being sick.
They just
as a preventative.
So then that's part of what that cheap meat is, and it has a lot of antibiotics in it, right?
Yeah, I would assume so.
Now, what happens to that, and do we eat that stuff too?
Well, you know, I don't know the physiology of how the antibiotics go through the animal
food chain,
food chain, but I don't really want to think about it.
Okay. So there you are. Okay. So there are nutritional reasons and there are environmental reasons why people are turning to grass-fed beef. Nutritional reasons stand to reason. You know, when you're feeding a ruminant grasses and the green grasses provide that wonderful balance of omega-3 and omega-6s, great beta-carotene, vitamin E, CLAs. Everything seems to be pointing in the direction of grass-fed with respect
lower
to...
Lower cholesterol.
Lower on cholesterol, yeah. What about taste?
Well, this is like I told you 15 years ago when we first tasted the grass-fed beef. We never went back. To me, feedlot beef is tasteless. And to get a flavor out of a feedlot beef, you actually need to have a fair amount of fat, like the flavors in the fat.
Flavors in fat.
Whereas the grass-fed beef, the flavors in the meat. And some people think it's gamey.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not used to the flavor in the meat, you might think it's a little gamey, but I like it. It has flavor. And not only that, it's leaner. Some people think it's tough, but I don't think it's tough at all.
Mm-hmm.
You can have as tender a beef as you can that's marbled. And the other day at the market, I had a man come through and he says, "Let me look at one of your steaks." And I pulled one out and he's like, "Not a lot of marbling in there, is there?" And I'm like, "No, it's very lean, healthy," going through the whole spiel. And he's like, walks away and says, "Ah, I like the marbling."
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so there are some people who...
Yeah.
Look for that.
Right, right. So with respect to what is that marbling? It's just fat.
It's fat, basically. And that's what the grain will give them, is that extra fat in the meat, in the muscle tissue.
So that's what we're getting. And that's so it's kind of like cutting the meat with fat. I mean, it's like reducing the nutrients with fat.
Yes. And to me, sometimes when I go into a restaurant and I'll order a commercially raised feedlot steak or something, and I'll say, well, oh, you know, this tastes pretty good, but then I realize that it's actually the marinade or whatever spices the person's put on the meat, and you can't really taste the meat flavor. What you're tasting is the marinade or the spices.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when people come to my table and they ask, you know, well, how should I cook this? And I'll just say, you know, rub it with a little olive oil, a little salt. That's it, because you're going to get the flavor of the meat,
so
you're going to like it.
The flavor is there. Well, and then let's talk about the environmental reasons why people are turning to grass-fed. What do you mean, environmental reasons?
I think, you know, we've all been hearing about the feedlots and how horrible they are. The mounds and mounds of manure that are created, and the water getting in, the E. coli getting into the water tables, and, you know, contaminating fields that are next to it, like the problem with the spinach and the E. coli. That was why, that's how that happened. So those are some of the negative aspects of the environmental question. Some positive aspects of the grass-fed environmental question are that we have grasslands around here that need to be grazed, that need to be mowed.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know,
otherwise,
you
have fires.
Yes. Yeah. And so if you are careful about not overgrazing, if you manage your pastures in a certain way, you can maintain the grasses, but without overgrazing them and keeping the fire hazards down.
You know, I have a good friend Joel Salatin out in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia.
I've read his books.
And I spent a weekend with him and Teresa, and he took me out to his pasture to show me how he rotated his animals through the pasture, and he had these little electric fences. And I'll never forget him taking a fence down and how his cows went from one pasture to the next. And they were the happiest damn cows I've ever seen in my life. They jumped and they skipped and they smiled and they danced into the next pasture. And I thought, being raised in Montana, I've been around cows a long time, but I've never seen
happy cows.
A happy cow. Yeah, it was a happy cow. It was dancing. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And that leads me to the next thing, which is probably something we're going to have to pick up after the break. And that's the humane reason for turning to grass-fed beef. You know, whenever I drive by those giant feedlots, I get depressed. I look out.
So are the cows.
Yeah. So are the cows. They have to be. I mean, it's like a giant prison or something, where everything is just confined and compressed. And the cows are standing there in fecal matter up to their knees. And
the whole process from there to when they're actually harvested is very stressful for the cows.
So you think cows are... I know they are. You know, just seeing Joel Salatin's happy cows, you know they have emotions. And so, I don't know, I never thought I'd be saying this, coming from Montana and all, but I guess, that it's just depressing to see that feedlot beef.
I agree.
So I guess there's nutritional reasons why people are turning to grass-fed.
Well, if you think of the stress hormones that are released into the meat before they're harvested and during that time of their life.
You know, that was something I learned a lot about in being raised in Montana. We hunted a lot. You know, we hunted animals. And it was always important to take down a deer, for example, in the least stressful way possible, because the meat would always reflect exactly how you did it. And it looks like it's time for a break. Are we up for a break?
Yeah.
Miss Nikki?
I can't hear the music over your music, so.
Okay. All right, we're going to go to a break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Elizabeth Shelley from Tassajara Natural Meats, Carmel Valley, California. When we come back, more about grass-fed or beef. Is it meat for the elite? What do you think? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, it's Yum Day here at the Farmer's Market, and there are thousands of people just running around eating and this and tasting that and smiling at each other and having a great time. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for the hour. Today we're talking with Elizabeth Shelley from Tassajara Natural Meats. Elizabeth, you're a city girl.
Yeah, I grew up mostly in cities. Yes, I did, but I always wanted to live on a farm.
So how was it when you started running around chasing cows?
Well, like I said, when we moved from the coast farther inland and we started seeing all these cows, we were sort of wondering where they would all go and why don't they stay in the area? Why can't all this meat that's out here in Carmel Valley where we live, why can't it just stay in this area? And so we started looking into that and trying to figure out how we could provide our local community with this grass-fed beef, that there are hundreds of head of cow just between Highway 1 and and 26 miles where
sure,
we live.
Sure, sure. And most of those cows, like most places in the United States, get taken off the land, off the pasture, put in trucks, hauled off to a distant feedlot, fed out on grain. And it all seems so bizarre when it gets right down to it. You know, it just seems so bizarre.
Well, and then from the feedlot for 6 months, they go to a slaughterhouse and they get packaged and it gets shipped off who knows where, back to where it came from, across the country, everywhere.
So we talked about why people turn to grass-fed. There's nutritional reasons, there are environmental reasons, and there are, you know, the humane reasons of the fact that we shouldn't really be treating other living creatures like we're treating cattle in feedlots and chickens in factories and pork in factories. And but this leads us, you know, how on earth do we do it otherwise? And you being naive, probably the perfect person to ask that question. Why can't we do it locally? Why can't we have these cattle? How do you go about doing that?
Well,
did people think you were crazy?
No.
No?
I think people were very happy. I mean, I think for the most part they would agree. At least, you know, although I live in a bubble. So people that I...
You don't listen to anybody else, right?
The people that are my friends, that are my community, all think the way I do. So.
Right, okay.
But when we started investigating...
So you haven't talked about this with the Western Cattlemen's Association?
No.
Okay.
No.
Right.
Although they may be aware of who we are. But, you know, it's not as easy as it sounds. And we were sort of a little disappointed in how difficult it has been to actually bring grass-faced food
to
market.
Why is it difficult? What makes it difficult to bring grass-fed beef, to bring local beef to the local market?
Well, mostly it has to do with the rules and regulations of that the government has put in place for good reason. I mean, they're there to protect us, really.
Are they?
I'm beginning to think
that there are two reasons for these rules. One of them is, as you say, to protect us, and the other is, I think, to protect vested interests.
Yes. Well, I would agree with that. Apparently, there are four large companies that control like 75% of the meat in this country, mm-hmm. slaughterhouses and everything. So I think that in some ways you are correct to say that it also protects the larger interests involved in the meat processing situation.
So for you to be able to harvest beef and bring it to the local community, you have to jump through some hoops that are designed to protect us against bad food, but also are designed to make it almost impossible for you to do that.
Yeah,
right?
That's correct. And expensive.
And expensive, yeah.
It's difficult for us. We don't have a large overhead, but we don't make a lot of extra money on this. The deal is that we have to go through a USDA certified slaughterhouse for when they actually kill the animal and then when it's packaged. And they're kind of few and far between, especially if you want to go, if we like to choose the smaller slaughterhouses. We don't like the big ones where, you know, hundreds of head of cow are going through
every
day.
Because you don't know which cow you're going to get when it comes out the other end.
And
right?
That's exactly kind of what happens to that many cows that go through, especially with the ground beef, which is where they've had the most problems with the E. coli, is that it all kind of gets mixed together from all these different cows, and then comes out the other end.
And so if you're going through all this trouble to grass-fed your beef and to take extra special good care of it and to harvest it at the perfect time, and then they take this beef and chop it up and throw it in the grinder with everybody else's cows, what difference does it make?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Exactly.
So you look for a different kind
so
of...
So we look for small slaughterhouses, which are hard to find, that have a USDA inspector mm-hmm. at the facility. And they're few and far between, and we're losing more and more of them every day, mm-hmm. the smaller ones.
And the reason we're losing them is
I think
for food safety, or is it because... the rules for doing these things are becoming so prohibitive that only giant operations can afford to hire the attorneys and the inspectors and everything else?
I think it's exactly that. I was talking with somebody from a slaughterhouse the other day who was talking about the amount of paperwork. They have to hire someone just to do the paperwork mm-hmm. for the USDA. And, you know, that gets expensive for them to do that, just to hire one person. And the inspector has to have his own bathroom facility, and there are just certain requirements.
The inspector has to have his own bathroom
yes.
facility?
Yes.
Okay.
So
maybe his own chauffeur and a chef, too. Yeah, right. Okay.
Hey, we got to take a...
the meat.
No, it's okay. We got to take a break in about a minute, but
okay.
Can we take a phone call before we go?
Yeah, let's take a phone call. Who do we have? We have Bob? Are you there, Bob?
Yeah, we've got Bob from Wattsville, and Bob, you are on the air.
I'm not sure I'm on the air with the technical difficulties today. I guess I...
You are. Go.
I have to blather it out. I'm finding contradictions. If the fat from grass-fed meat is so good, why should it be lean? And as a consumer, I buy grass-fed meat that is grass-finished, that is the animals spend their final years, or at least their final 6 months, on really rich pasture, and you get the fat and the marbling, and it's a good eating experience to have the marbling in there. And as far as the elite goes, I think you've touched on it, it's economical and inexpensive to raise animals on grass, but where the consumer has to pay more is for all of the processing and the regulatory sequela. So I guess because of the technical difficulties, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, thanks for the call, Bob. I don't know if you can hear us, but we appreciate it. Now, how close are we to the break, Miss Nikki?
We should start it right now.
Okay. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, we'll address Bob's questions and comments. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Elizabeth Shelley, Tassajara Natural Meats, broadcasting live from the Monterey Bay Certified Farmers Markets in the central coast of California. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Hey, we're back, and fortunately, we have Debbie Dolworth back from Dogwood Farm down there in La Center, Kentucky. Debbie's going to try to chime in here with a comment with respect to grass-fed. Debbie, take it away.
Yes, we have been raising grass-fed beef since 1965, basically, and we've been marketing it locally since about 2003. And we have found a great many challenges along the way, partly the USDA inspection process that you have talked about. There is not a USDA inspector within, it's about 90 miles to the closest one. And the dearth of processors has been a big hurdle. Another hurdle for us lately, ever since we started doing this, is weather. The weather is so extreme that it does cut our profits and our ability to make a living at this. We've been through ice storms and tornadoes and floods and droughts and the whole gamut in the past 8 years. So I hope, I'm sorry that we couldn't make a connection today, but I hope that in the future we can talk about some of the problems and some of the blessings of raising grass-fed beef, and I can bring a little different perspective on it.
Well, thank you very much for that comment, Debbie, and by golly, we will connect with you somehow in the future, because I would love to hear what it's like to be doing this in Kentucky, because one of the things that really fascinated me about what Debbie had to say was that her customers for her grass-fed beef are not the elite. They are regular people who are just looking for a more reasonable way to feed their bodies. And they see in her grass-fed beef one of the ways to do that. Bob brought up some interesting comments, and perhaps Elizabeth Shelley can address them with respect to the fats in the grass-fed beef. He was looking for that fat. Where
yeah.
does he?
Well, and I'm sorry if there's a misunderstanding earlier. We tend to take our animals fairly young, and so there's not a lot of marbling. But if you allow them to continue on grass for another year or two even, then, of course, they will get bigger and more marbling, more fat in the beef. So it's not to say that grass-fed beef does not have marbling. That's not true.
So it's just a cultural practice then, essentially.
Yes. Well, and part of that has to do with California's weather, as
right.
Debbie mentioned, that there are 6 months of the year with no water here, no rain. And so the cows, the young cows are raised during the rainy season when the grasses are green, and then in the spring when it starts to dry up, they need to be taken away. And that's why here most of the cows go to market in the spring, in the middle summer when it's dried out, because in an effort not to overgraze, you
right.
have to reduce your herd. And so that is also a difficulty, and we're small. We don't have a facility to take all those animals and process them and store them for the rest of the year. So we try and keep a few of the herd behind if we can, but we don't want to overgraze. So it's
okay, difficult. So that's why you take your animals when they're relatively
yeah.
young then. And aren't they more tender, too, that way?
Yes.
I mean, you delicious. Might get more fat, but they
milk
might
fed.
Not. Yeah.
Well, we call it free-range veal.
Free-range veal. Yeah. Yum. Okay. And I've heard people making efforts to have mobile abattoirs. Where?
Yes.
Why can't we just do that? Why can't we have portable abattoirs where they could come to each local farm or each local ranch and harvest the beef there?
Well, again, there are difficulties with that in terms of the regulations. And the mobile unit can't just go from place to place and slaughter. You actually have to have a little facility where the mobile unit goes to, a pad where everything is processed, like a cement pad.
Right.
That's one drawback. And so the best thing is if local ranchers create a cooperative where they can bring their cows to this one pad. The next problem is that the mobile slaughter unit is not really tall enough to do the cows, especially the very large ones.
Right.
And so the beef has to be quartered. And when they quarter it, you lose a lot of the expensive, delicious cuts. The next thing is that even though they're being slaughtered there on the property, which is a better way to do it, killed rather, you still have to take
process.
Them to a facility to process them,
it, yeah.
to package it. So there are a lot of issues that are trying. The mobile slaughter unit is really better for smaller animals like the goats,
hogs,
right. lamb, chickens.
Mm-hmm. So what are the odds of getting farmers and ranchers to work together in a situation like this where you could actually, regionally produce your own beef that way?
Well, my husband's actually involved in working with a cooperative of ranchers around here to try and figure out some of these issues that we're facing. And for the most part, he hasn't found it to be that difficult. But there are a fair amount of ranchers out here who, this is their lifestyle. They've been doing this their whole lives. They come from generations of ranchers.
Right.
And they just sort of continue what they've been doing over the past,
right.
And the,
this whole notion
years.
Of being a marketing person is probably foreign to
yes.
them. You know, what do you mean?
Yes.
We raise the cattle and get rid of them and
yes.
let somebody else deal with the other problems.
That's correct. But, I think at some point when they realize that they can actually make a little bit more money this way, that it might work for them.
Well, this time I hear the break music, and we have a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Elizabeth what her biggest mistake was and how they overcame that. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about grass-fed beef. Yum, as far as I'm concerned. I know what I'm looking for now. with Elizabeth Shelley, and we're also talking with Debbie Dolworth out in Dogwood Farm in La Center, Kentucky. And you, we will be right back after this brief message and continue. So much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Elizabeth Shelley, Tassajara Natural Meats. City girl moves to the country, starts raising grass-fed beef. Elizabeth, that must have been a heck of an experience. I think of Eddie Alpert and Green Acres television show. So tell us, what was your biggest boo-boo, And it's because a city girl takes over cows, and they must have had some great stories there.
Well, I think we haven't been in business that long. I think our biggest mistake may have been getting into the business and to begin with, but we haven't quite resolved that one yet.
Yeah, so it's been, I suppose, a heck of a change, though. I mean, a big learning curve.
Yes, and we're still on the learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
Although, my husband has had a fair amount of experience in business, and so he comes at it from a business mind,
perspective.
And
yeah.
I think he's doing a great job.
That probably makes a big difference.
And yes.
Whether you can survive this or not, if you approach it as a business. So let's talk about what people can do when they go out shopping for food and looking for meat and considering meat.
Well, as consumers, we have a huge amount of power. I think we have more power than we actually think we do. And so I always tell people and recommend that when they go to places that sell grass-fed beef or beef in general, just to ask the butcher or whoever, ask them where the meat comes from. Ask them if it was finished on grain or if it was 100% grass start to finish. Just ask questions about your mm-hmm. food in general and see if they can answer your questions.
You know, that really does change the whole dynamic of who's in charge.
Yes.
When you know nothing and you go by, for example, strawberries, and it's just a generic strawberry there, then all the power is in the hand of the grocer and the marketing people, because they can buy the cheapest strawberries from anywhere in the world, and if all you care about is buying a strawberry, then cheap food, then they own you. But if you go up and say, hey, I want to buy a Driscoll strawberry, and then who's in charge?
Yeah.
Driscoll is, you know, because they have that power, then you're looking for not only just a berry, but you're looking for a Driscoll berry. So the same is true with what you say. You know, if people are actually looking for grass-fed beef, and you go up into the butcher and you say, I want grass-fed beef. How do you feed your, how are these?
Yeah, I want grass-fed beef and I want 100% finished on grass. Because often they will, even the grass-fed beef they'll advertise as grass-fed, but they'll finish it on grain.
So there you are. So, but when you ask, you have the power.
Yes, you're ultimately
and
the one that's paying.
You strike terror into the heart of the butcher, because then the butcher has to satisfy you.
Yes, and you're paying the money, so you have the money. They're not going to go anywhere if you're not paying for what you request.
How do you sell your beef?
We sell it at farmers market.
At farmers market?
Yeah, one farmers market we're doing right now.
And that is?
At MPC on Fridays.
Now, how do people find you?
They can call us or they can find us at the market.
What about your website?
It's TassaharaMeats.com or TassaharaMeats.com, I think it's both.
Okay, Elizabeth Shelley, thank you for joining us today on The Food Chain. Also, big thanks to Debbie Dulworth out there in Dogwood Farm in La Center, Kentucky. And thank you all for tuning in. What do you think? Do you think grass-fed meat is meat for the elite? You can answer on the forum page at metrofarm.com and see what Debbie had to say there, too. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.